in the limelight.
Police in Minneapolis, Minnesota suburb said an officer accidentally shot and killed a 20-year-old black man on Sunday afternoon, 11th of April, during a traffic stop. Releasing graphic body camera footage that shows the officer intended to use a taser, not a handgun, during the death of unarmed Duante Wright. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalists Oliver Lachlan, Amudalat Ajasa and Tom McCarthy. The piece is titled "Police Say Officer Who Shot and Killed Unarmed Duante Wright Intended to Fire Taser." Police in a Minneapolis suburb have said an officer accidentally shot and killed a 20-year-old black man on Sunday afternoon, 11th of April, during a traffic stop, releasing graphic body camera footage that they say showed the officer intended to use a taser and not a handgun during the death of unarmed Duante Wright. The incident plunged the suburb of Brooklyn Center into a night of unrest as Minneapolis remains on edge during the murder trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin over the death of George Floyd. Hundreds of protesters clashed with police in riot gear who deployed tear gas and flashbangs to disperse the crowds. At a press conference inside Brooklyn Center Police Headquarters, surrounded by riot police and National Guard troops, the police chief Tim Gannon described the shooting as an accidental discharge and confirmed no weapon had been recovered from Wright's vehicle. The county medical examiner has ruled the death a homicide. The mayor of Brooklyn Center, Mike Elliott, said he had spoken to President Joe Biden, who offered assistance. "I want to say that our hearts are aching right now," Mayor Mike Elliott told reporters. "We are in pain right now, and we recognize that this couldn't have happened at a worse time. We will get to the bottom of this. We will do all that there is in our power to make sure that justice is done for Duante Wright." Mayor Mike Elliott also said he supported firing the police officer involved in this case. Protesters returned to the street again on Monday evening, 12th of April, despite a 7 p.m. curfew imposed by the governor of Minnesota. Hundreds of people gathered in the cold and rainy weather outside the Brooklyn Center Police Department, which was ringed by a metal fence, concrete barriers, and police dressed in riot gear. A few hundred protesters gathered outside the Brooklyn Center Police Department, which is circled by fencing. Protesters have also blockaded off parts of Humboldt Avenue. Earlier in the day, mourners and outraged community members had made their way to the site where Duante Wright was killed. On a grey, damp morning, Ben Witz and his sister came to the site to lay balloons. "This is more difficult because there was another unarmed shooting," Witz said, explaining that family members lived in the area and that the community was still traumatized from George Floyd's killing and the unrest that followed. "It seems like it's a common occurrence now with the police," Witt said. "It's crazy what is happening, it really is." According to Brooklyn Center Police, the incident occurred shortly before 2 p.m. when a police officer pulled over a vehicle due to an alleged traffic violation. The body camera footage showed Duante Wright being apprehended by two police officers when a third female officer approaches the scene. A struggle ensues and Duarte Wright gets back into his vehicle, at which point the female police officer opens fire. "I just shot him," the officer is heard saying. As the body camera footage was released, a small group of activists in the police headquarters waiting area demanded the officer, who has not been identified, to be fired immediately. "Seeing the video just confirms what we already knew," said Toshiro Garraway, the founder of Families Supporting Families Against Police Violence. "It's just killing after killing after killing." She added, "They will always say I was afraid or it was an accident, but the fact of the matter is, this was murder. If she's not fired, this is only going to escalate." Duarte Wright's mother, Katie Wright, told reporters she was on the phone with her son as the encounter occurred. According to her account, reported by local television news, her son called as he was being pulled over and asked about insurance for the vehicle, which she had recently given him. She said she heard police officers instruct her son to get out of the car and then scuffling shortly before the phone hung up. "A minute later, I called and his girlfriend answered the phone. His girlfriend was the passenger inside the car and said that he'd been shot, and she put it on the driver's side and my son was laying there lifeless," she said. Police said officers determined the driver had an outstanding warrant. Heavily armoured National Guard troops worked to barricade the police station on Monday morning, 12th of April, as fewer than a dozen protesters faced the building across the road. Two National Guard Humvees, guardsmen carrying long guns, and dozens of police officers in riot gear were outside the station as police installed concrete blocks. A couple of members of the original Black Panthers of Minneapolis group chatted with state troopers. Ben Witz, a 40-year-old, said he was concerned that businesses in the area would be vandalized if protesters over Wright's killing led to major unrest. "It was like a war zone," Ben Witz said, "of the unrest that followed George Floyd's death, and now we're seeing it here. And I mean, why do we have to vandalize? I mean, as a white person, I don't get it, but I want to be educated." On Sunday evening, 11th of April, hundreds of protesters marched to the police station and were met by police officers in riot gear who discharged tear gas, flashbangs and other munitions. Crowds had largely dispersed by midnight. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety Commissioner John Harrington said around 20 businesses at the Shingle Creek Shopping Center were broken into. The mayor, Mike Elliott, urged protesters to be peaceful and that peaceful protesters are not dealt with force. Brooklyn Center is a suburb in northwest Minneapolis with a population of about 30,000. Tensions are high as the murder trial of Derek Chauvin entered its third week. Amid drizzle and gray skies on Monday, protesters such as Bethany Hembridge came to pay her respects near the site where Duarte Wright had been shot dead less than 24 hours before. "As a mother of a black child, I couldn't even fathom," Hemrich, who is white, said. "My son is 10 years old and I brought him to the George Floyd Memorial and had to explain racism to him." As her voice broke, she continued, "They didn't have to kill him. I feel like if it was a white person, they wouldn't have shot him." Quinn Redeem, the 46-year-old, spoke of the tension in the area around police-involved deaths of black people. Redeem said, "This just added gasoline to the fire. We're tired and fired up. The world needs to really see what's going on. And now the world is watching Minnesota."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. 'Cause Ramadan is here. Whoa, Ramadan is here. Today's lesson: the effects of fasting and hunger. It has been narrated from the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, "Don't say Ramadan because you don't know what Ramadan is. Instead of saying Ramadan, say the way Allah has called it, the month of Ramadan." The most important duty of a devoted wayfarer in this month, in this great month rather, is to understand the right of this holy month in which Allah has invited the wayfarer of his path for a feast. Also, he must understand the correct meanings of fasting and its relevance with Allah's invitation. Having discovered this reality, he must endeavor that all his actions and deeds are accompanied with required devotion and sincerity in order to earn the pleasure of his host Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is how the Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, needs to be looked at.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin nur al-mubin marhaban bit-ta'ibin مرحبا بالعابدين في صلاة الخاشعين في رحاب الذاكرين رمضان 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 القانتين. Welcome
back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the effects of fasting and hunger. Tolerance of hunger, the most obvious part of fasting, earns plenty of advantages for a devoted wayfarer journeying towards Allah's path from the point of view of enlightenment and knowledge of Allah. In addition to this, his advancement in attaining spiritual perfection becomes possible in this very month. This has been emphasized in plenty of narrations from Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. Engaging yourself in self-struggle, which is also known as jihad an-nafs, through the means of hunger and thirst, whose reward is equivalent to the rewards of those who participated in the armed struggle for Allah's sake. There is nothing more superior before Allah's sight than tolerating hunger and thirst during fasting. This is how the outlook on the holy month of Ramadan is. This is that great and blessed month where the doors of mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala open up for His servants, those servants who are serious to attain that spiritual elevation. Allah makes it easier for them to get to that desired level. So brothers and sisters, we have to make sure that we understand and realize the effects of fasting and hunger in the holy month of Ramadan. Surely it is something that we all can benefit from.
Everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on. everything I've done in the light, for everything I've done in the night that I thought wasn't wrong.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Everything that wasn't right, going through life like a fool. Forgive me before the day comes when I die. I open up my eyes, now I'm trying to fight. Cause I've walked away. Came back for you.
Back for you.
Don't take me away.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
A group of activists in the U.S. has held rallies in Washington, D.C. to call for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The activists from the Yemeni Liberation Movement have been on hunger strike since March 29th to call on the U.S. government to cease support for Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and draw attention to the plight of millions of Yemenis facing malnutrition and starvation. The protesters say what they're going through doesn't compare with the pain experienced by war-weary Yemenis, but it can raise awareness about the dire humanitarian situation in the Arab nation.
So, as someone who's part of Yemeni Liberation Movement, we believe in self-determination. So for the people of Yemen to determine for themselves the way that they want to live. And they're not able right now to make those decisions because they're actively and violently being starved by the U.S. government and by the Saudi-UAE coalition.
Experts say the fact that a growing number of people in the U.S., including politicians, are now demanding an end to the years-long war is a positive development, but not enough to end the conflict.
Everybody can imagine just how much your health and well-being is impacted. And I do hope that those who are watching and seeing realize that the longer that you all are on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen.
But what steps can the international community take to ensure it can put an end to the deadly crisis? During his first foreign policy speech, U.S. President Joe Biden laid out his agenda for the Yemen conflict.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that the Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon. But even that couldn't stop Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. Although the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen escalated under former U.S. President Donald Trump with his administration's boundless support for the Saudis, the war began when Joe Biden was incumbent as a U.S. vice president in the Barack Obama administration.
I mean, I think Biden's silence speaks volumes, right? So since 2015, an administration that he was a part of, he's actively chosen billions and billions of dollars in weapon sales. Corporations have made billions and billions of dollars in sales, and they've decided that that money, right, is more important than the lives of Yemeni people. And it's more important than the child that dies every 75 seconds in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the National Salvation Government. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia assumed to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. Many observers believe that ending the war requires international pressure against Saudi Arabia and its regional allies, especially by their powerful partners, including the United States. But whether or not those nations' wider West Asia policies allow risking their ties with Riyadh is anybody's guess.
The latest round of talks on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, ended in Vienna on Friday. The Austrian capital hosted 4 days of talks between delegates from Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal to revitalize the agreement. The U.S. also sent a delegation to Vienna, but Iran rejected to hold direct or indirect talks with them. Tehran and Washington remain in a standoff as both sides call on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. While the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to rejoin the JCPOA, so far it has refused to remove sanctions. The U.S. says it is prepared to lift sanctions that are inconsistent with the JCPOA. While it has declined to elaborate, that appears to exclude sanctions formally related to nuclear issues covered by the deal. Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing the logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the 2015 nuclear accord. As the first round of negotiations finished on Friday, the participants agreed to hold another round of talks next Wednesday in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The negotiations are going to be about removal of sanctions and nuclear implementation of the deal.
We know that Trump's maximum pressure campaign failed against Iran. And Iran has emerged with an economy more resistant to external pressure and so insulated from the U.S. sanctions.
China has said the U.S. should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally and remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman described the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from 2015 nuclear deal as the root cause of the crisis. During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA by calling it a weak agreement. Then Washington used the maximum pressure campaign to wage an economic war on Tehran to force it to renegotiate. The Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, previously said that unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. inflicted $1 trillion worth of damage on Iran's economy. He said Iran expects compensation after Washington rejoins the accord. A senior U.S. State Department official has predicted if Tehran insists on the removal of all sanctions imposed since 2017, Washington will reach an impasse.
Iran, in the current situation, has limited the negotiations to only two expert committees. One is active and one is standby. The active expert committee is working to assess and present measures that the United States is needed to implement to be able to come back to the full compliance with the JCPOA.
Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. How could the U.S. want a mutual return while they withdrew from the deal and Iran is still part of it? It is clear that the U.S. will leave Vienna empty-handed if the outcome of the talks is anything but removal of all sanctions.
A research monitoring group on global arms sales has confirmed that the United States maintains its status as the world's biggest exporter of weapons, a title that Washington has held since the end of the Cold War. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, also referred to as SIPRI, found that between 2016 and 2020, around 47% of all U.S. arms exports went to American allies in the Middle East. That's a rise of 28% compared to the previous 5 years. In a report, it found that U.S. exports to North Africa had also witnessed a spike. Generally, global arms sales stabilized with the exception of the Middle East and North Africa. The research suggests these two destinations are lucrative markets for Western arms suppliers, despite the wars, the death and the destruction in the two regions. Analysts are left asking how Washington can talk of peace in Yemen, for example, while it is complicit in the killing of civilians there. Saudi Arabia made up 11% of the total arms import market worldwide and is the biggest importer of US, UK and Canadian arms. In February, US President Joe Biden had claimed that Washington would end relevant arms sales to Saudi Arabia that are being used in the kingdom's war on Yemen, which he referred to as offensive weapons. But arms controls advocates are not exactly celebrating. They are calling for more transparency. The Center for Civilians in Conflict says it's not quite clear yet where the administration will land on what weapons they deem to be offensive. The Washington-based NGO also says, "We've seen other sales that indicate the Biden administration may be staying the course on less high-profile but still very concerning arms sales." Just recently, the Biden administration had been condemned for approving a $197 million arms sale to Egypt, despite human rights concerns there. The CIPRI report also reveals that not only was the US the largest exporter of weapons, but over the last 5 years, its global share of arms exports had increased from 32 to 37%. In contrast, Russian arms exports decreased by 22% during the same period. This has increased the gap between the two of the world's largest exporters of arms. The report also notes that the US had supplied major arms to 96 countries, far more than any other nation. Saudi Arabia alone accounted for 24% of all US arms sales. Analysts say conflicts such as the Saudi war on Yemen can quite easily come to an end if Washington halts its large arms exports. Critics also argue that by sending arms to conflict zones, the US has put profit for its arms manufacturing companies over the lives of innocent civilians. Project South has described CIPRI's findings as deplorable. The advocacy group says the US government specifically is willing to close its eyes on the atrocities committed by governments if they are reliable importers of US-made war-making machines. It added that, instead of supporting peace, the global north continues the colonial tradition of war-making. This also explains the lack of concrete action on the systematic human rights abuses of countries such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Rights groups have heavily criticized America's long-standing warm ties with dictatorships in West Asia. They argue that despite these regimes waging war on other countries and despite their terrible rights record, the lucrative arms trade appears to come first for Washington. Peace advocates also argue that as the arms exports allow conflicts to drag on and on, American arms manufacturers count their ever-expanding profits over an ever-expanding list of dead women and children.
The government in Baghdad is under pressure from the parliament and many political groups to force out the remaining U.S. troops in Iraq. Calls for the withdrawal of all American troops have been growing louder amid rising anti-U.S. sentiments across Iraq. There have been popular demonstrations against the presence of foreign troops on Iraqi soil. Meanwhile, U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq have come under a growing number of attacks over the past months. It's been proving more difficult to protect foreign troops who have defied the calls to leave. This week, Baghdad and Washington agreed on the withdrawal of all remaining U.S. and coalition combat troops from Iraq. The two sides issued a statement saying that the agreement was reached following their first strategic dialogue under U.S. President Joe Biden. But this week's agreement does not mean that the mission of U.S. and American-led forces in Iraq is over. They will still provide training and assistance to Iraqi armed forces. The Iraqi army says it will set up a committee that would hold technical talks with the U.S. to draw up mechanisms and timings related to the redeployment. How will political parties and resistance groups react to this week's announcement? Critics have questioned the agreement, arguing that Baghdad could find it difficult to sell the new arrangement to the Iraqi people and political groups.
I think the U.S. has no intention to really leave Iraq or the region. I think they will make one pretense after another, one negotiation after another, one renaming of the troops that they have in country, but I don't think they plan to leave.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. The anti-Americanism was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attacks on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces. But America is still refusing to heed that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safer, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, the U.S. withdrew several hundreds of its forces from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite repeated pledges to end American military presence in the region. The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from former U.S. President Donald Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region.
In terms of resources, Africa's abundance of natural resources provides long-term economic benefits for countries seeking it. The potential of the continent to develop renewable energy is immense. It is an instant attraction for Indian entrepreneurs who are looking to invest in the energy sector. I prepared for an article written by Amira Rao, a research assistant at the Takshashila Institution, a public policy think tank based in Bangalore, India. The piece is titled, India Should Cooperate with Africa in Renewable Energy. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Amira Rao's article. Recently, India entered a strategic partnership with the International Energy Agency, IEA. The executive director of the International Energy Agency, IEA, said, India will have a critical role in shaping the world's energy and climate future. Now, India will see great potential in creating renewable energy and must partner up with other countries in this space. Africa has been seeing positive developments mainly in its solar energy expansion. The two regions seem to have a great future ahead of them and could create greater results by cooperating. South Africa and Egypt are leading the race as big solar powers in the African continent. The two are also the only countries to be part of the Solar Gigawatt Club, nations with the capacity to produce 1 gigawatt of solar power. However, according to the annual Africa Solar Outlook report of 2021, more countries, that is, Algeria, Zimbabwe, Angola, Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Morocco and Botswana, to name a few, are hiking up their solar capacities. The potential of hydrogen is also being recognized as a crucial tool in the global solar market with a promise to meet cleaner energy goals. Other sweeping changes include the construction of floating solar panels formed by Africa's hydropower dams that could potentially double African hydropower capacity and act as a new power generation source. Hydropower accounts for about 90% of the electricity generation in smaller African nations such as Ethiopia, Mozambique, and Zambia. Such developments are vital in areas that suffer from inadequate power generating capacity. After South Africa, Africa is the second largest recipient of Indian funds, with lines of credit worth nearly $10 billion reserved for projects in more than 100 countries. The Minister of External Affairs in India, Subrahmanyam Jaishankar, has also previously mentioned that India is one of the biggest investors in the African continent, amounting to about $54 billion. Such an inflow of income can contribute towards infrastructure development and finances for resources, the two biggest hindrances in Africa's renewable energy space. With considerable financial and technical assistance from India, Africa can be one of the top players in the energy field. In his 2018 speech in Uganda, one of the principles mentioned by Prime Minister Narendra Modi as part of India's engagement with Africa was the need to address challenges of climate change and adopt efficient energy sources. Cross-border energy trade is a crucial agenda of the Narendra Modi government's neighborhood first policy. India's attitude towards Africa thus reflects a long-standing commitment. The formation of new relationships indicates an increased scope for collaboration in the energy field. For example, Ghana in West Africa has expressed interest in tying up with India in the nuclear energy space and is on the lookout for investors to expand in this area. India could be a prime candidate focusing on technology sharing, supply of raw materials, availability of uranium, and the sharing of common experiences. Both India and Africa are new to nuclear technology, so a collaboration here could set the bar high for contending powers in the nuclear space. Meanwhile, in Malawi and the Gambia, India has planned to create solar power parks to meet electricity needs and demands in those countries. The project is being undertaken by one of India's largest power corporations, the National Thermal Power Corporation Limited, or NTPC. The engagement of public and private Indian enterprises in Africa is something that India should maintain to develop closer connections to the African continent and reap its benefits. Being part of international treaties like the International Solar Alliance is a massive boost for Indian-African relations and India's position as an emerging solar power in the world order. The NTPC, the National Thermal Power Corporation Limited, has already landed project management consultancy contracts for developing solar parks in Togo, eyeing opportunities in Sudan, Mozambique, Egypt, Uganda, Rwanda, and Niger, and their ISA members. Mauritius and Kenya, too, have encouraged Indian cooperation concerning solar energy. For India, the key benefit lies in reformulating its strategy to become an important influence in the African continent. As a member of the ISA, the International Solar Alliance, and helping NTPC secure energy project contracts in Africa, the main objective of New Delhi is to mobilize its presence in the region and compete against China. The International Solar Alliance, ISA, is viewed as a foreign policy tool for India to secure deeper involvement. With China ramping up its Belt and Road Initiative strategy across the African continent, the National Thermal Power Corporation Limited, NTPC, aims to try and achieve a role as a key consultant to the African member countries of ISA, the International Solar Alliance. It is also trying to lead against China in funding by setting up a World Solar Bank to achieve $50 billion annually. In terms of resources, Africa's abundance of natural resources provides long-term economic benefits for countries seeking it. The potential of the continent to develop renewable energy is immense. It is an instant attraction for Indian entrepreneurs who are looking to invest in the energy sector. Overall, with climate change ravaging the earth, the demand for green energy sources and solutions is rising now more than ever. Much more collaboration is needed among Indian and African partners. More than 25% of Africa's total energy will come from geothermal energy, hydropower energy, solar energy, and wind by 2040. It is the perfect time for India to bolster relations and work together to revise energy flow and consumption across the world.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan. What is the main philosophy of fasting in the month of Ramadan?
Our responsibility is to work hard to avoid sins and, to put it briefly, to show piety. Piety, which has been considered as the main philosophy and goal of fasting in the month of Ramadan, means this. Piety means taking care of oneself. We should constantly take care of ourselves. Of course, primarily, I'm addressing this statement to myself. All of us are responsible. Therefore, we should appreciate the value of the month of Ramadan. We should appreciate the value of this month of Ramadan, which we are in now. Thousands of thousand months of Ramadan have come and gone throughout history. And thousands of thousand months of Ramadan will come and go, during which time we are not living. Amid these billion months of Ramadan in history, we are present in a few of them. In this chain of the months of Ramadan of history, we have been given the opportunity to spend 20, 30, 50, 60 months of Ramadan from the age of taklif until the end of our lives. So we should appreciate the value of them.
رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
Month of Ramadan draws people's attention to life after death.
One issue that is repeated in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan is drawing people's attention to the worlds after this material world. The world of death, the world of the grave, the world of the judgment day, and one's difficulties in facing divine calculations and divine questioning. This is one of the issues that exist in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan. Paying attention to this is very important for us officials who have certain responsibilities. A factor that helps us control and monitor this is attention to these worlds. When we understand that, not the weight of an atom becomes absent from him, the Holy Quran chapter 34 verse 3, that no small move, action, and statement will escape the eyes of divine calculators after our death, and that we will be questioned about all these things, this will deeply affect our behavior, our statements, and our moves.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
Restaurateurs, gym owners, and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy, demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome, Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom, and let us get back to work," with some hurling, smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
L'esasperazione è tanta anche...
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings.
The protest turned nasty when protesters infiltrated by alt-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon.
The government keeps ignoring us. My shop has been closed since October, but the rent and all bills must be paid anyway. How can we continue this way? I am afraid some people will resort to extreme acts.
Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after six regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign. Max Civili, Rome.
Increasing the number of...
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Wrightcroft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a Prime Minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations' devolved governments are essentially self-governing. This has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England normally. He doesn't seem to care about the union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved governments and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions, with Wrightcroft claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag-waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbala, London.
This is the first time in over four decades that a South Korean Prime Minister visits Iran. Chung Sik-yoon arrived in Tehran on Sunday for a three-day visit that aims to boost bilateral ties. During his trip, Shang held talks with high-ranking Iranian officials, including Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf and Ali Larijani, who was an advisor to leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Shang's historic visit is viewed as an icebreaker to forge stronger ties between Seoul and Tehran after